Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Tuesday, the 11th of June, in May, a year ago, Eugene Schultz was a guest on one of our programs, this program, talking about World War II. And his memories were so striking that one of our other guests, who was doing an oral history, invited Eugene to come to Louisiana, I believe, to share his memories. Eugene at that time was in the middle of writing his memoirs, and they have, yes, just been published. The Ghost in General Patton's Third Army, the memoirs of Eugene Schultz during his service in the United States Army in World War II. I've read a good chunk of the book, and I must say, Gene is a marvelous writer, and I think that he really captures the substance of what it was like to be a very young man. He was just a teenager when he was drafted into the Army in World War II, and he had some absolutely remarkable experiences during the war, which we will hear about. We talked a year ago about his being an eyewitness to the first Nazi concentration camp that was discovered by American troops, horrors that he writes about quite vividly, and he writes about Eisenhower's response to those horrors and how people needed to be eyewitnesses so the world would know that indeed this did happen. He writes just exquisitely about the whole Normandy invasion and what a massive, massive operation that was. And he writes poignantly about what it was like to be a guy from a small town, Clintonville, Wisconsin, and going into this huge venture, and what it was like for his parents, who really didn't know where he was, or for himself, what might happen to him during the course of the war. So did I tell you the name of that? I didn't give you the name. The Ghost in General Patton's Third Army, the memoirs of Eugene Schultz during his service in the United States Army in War II. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Gene. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Gene, thank you so much for being with us again. And we liked you so much the last go around. And the book is just so good. I was saying to you before the show, not only did I learn a lot about you, but you really have researched the war and given us so much valuable information about the important theaters that you are a part of.
Well, thank you very much, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be on your show today. Yes, this was quite an endeavor I took on to write this book. It all started a few years, well, maybe back 10 years ago or so, when one of my grandsons, Benjamin Schultz, was just getting into his teen years, and he was interested in telling me his war stories. And so he was a history buff himself, and then when he got later on in high school, he kept urging me to write. Grandpa, he said, you got to write this stuff down. Uh-huh. And so my idea then was just to write my memoirs of my 3 years in the service and explain everything in such a way that my grandchildren could understand what I did and how life was in the war. And so my idea was just to leave a legacy to my grandchildren, and that they would be the only ones who would see this document, as well as my own families. But as word got around that I was writing these memoirs, there was much more interest in it from outsiders, and so I decided to maybe I should publish it. So this is what happened.
I'm so glad you did. Well, the other thing is that you were in so many very important theaters in this war, weren't you? To witness the concentration camp, the first, to be part of Normandy, to be part of the drive across France, and to meet the Russians in Austria. I mean, you were really at the center of important parts of World War II.
Yes, I certainly was. And it all took place because I was in the 20th Corps headquarters, and we were under General Patton's Third Army. Now, a Corps headquarters is a unit, which is mostly administrative. I was not a fighting soldier, so to speak, although I could fight. But I was an office worker, and my job was to type orders, battle orders, that were developed by my boss, who was a full colonel, Colonel mm-hmm. Griffith. And so I was privy to a lot of top secret information. And it was just amazing to me that here I was a kid like 19, 20 years old, and I was privy to all this fascinating information. And it's a remarkable thing.
Tell me where you were. You start the book with the news of Pearl Harbor, and I believe you were in the living room with your mom and your dad, and mm-hmm. you heard the news on the radio, and it changed everybody's lives, certainly.
Yeah, this was a Sunday afternoon, the first in December 1941, and after my mother was a great cook, and we had a nice chicken dinner, as we often did on Sundays. And so, as was our custom, my dad would lie on the couch to have his afternoon nap. And Sundays were precious to him because he was a farmer. And so that's what he did. My mother sat in an easy chair, and the radio was on. And I was a... as all teenage boys did in those days, we built model airplanes. And I loved to build balsa model planes, and I did make a number of them, but I decided to build a submarine. And this was a more complicated model.
Imagine.
Yeah. And so that's what I was working on in the living room with my mom and dad present. Well, all of a sudden the news was interrupted by this announcement that Pearl Harbor had been bombed, and that news was stunning, and it just, as I mentioned in the book, that changed my life.
Mm-hmm. And not that long after, you received a notice that you were to be a part of the Army.
That's right. I I was drafted then, and I was sent to the reception camp in Fort Sheridan, Illinois. In January of 1943.
Mm-hmm. And you were just a kid. You were 19 years old.
I know. It was amazing. But, you know, so many of my buddies from high school, they were in the service and enlisted in a specific branch of service. But for me, I said to myself, I'd just as soon be drafted. I will go in the Army. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happened. So I was happy I was going to say that my buddies from high school were all away from home. And so this was the thing to do. I was patriotic, and that's the way America was in those days.
Does it ever register when you're 19 years old? I'm sure it did with your mom and your dad. But does it ever register, or are you just caught up in the I can live forever and this is an important world event that I need to be a part of, really, to save our way of life? Do you ever think I might not make it back? Does that ever enter your mind when you're 19 or not?
Well, it's interesting because I felt that this was an adventure. I was really excited to get into the service, and I love to travel, and so this I felt was another way to see the world, and it was my patriotism that I felt, too. But I know my parents must have felt much differently.
Yes.
And now that I'm a parent and a grandparent, I'm beginning to feel how my parents must have felt.
Yes.
To let their son go into the war and the service and stuff like that.
I didn't realize some of the early chapters in your training I wonder if this happened to a lot of people in training, that you were preparing yourself for chemical warfare. That was an interesting part of the book, that you were actually subjected to some toxins on your body to, I guess, train for it, to see how you would respond to it and what to do about that. Can you talk about that?
Yes. In World War I, mustard gas was one of the great things that happened, and that was a vicious kind of chemical. What it did, it has dried up the mucous membranes when you inhale that. And so we were prepared for chemical warfare, and that was part of our training. We always carried gas masks. We learned how to use them. And then we went through where we were subjected to these various gases. And, we would enter a chamber and where the get was gas, and then we immediately had to put our gas masks on or, practice that way. And one of the things we did is we had actually mustard gas put on our arm. There's a spot on my left arm where I had a scab or a scar for many years.
Really?
And what had happened, that blistered up, and the scar remained for a long time. So we were really prepared for chemical warfare.
Right. So to make a longer story, because you went west and then you came back east, eventually you get on the Queen Elizabeth and you're going, and I can't quite imagine this, you don't know where you're going exactly. You don't know if you're going to Europe. You don't know if you're going to the Pacific Theater. You don't know where you're going, right?
Yes.
You're being sent somewhere.
Well, it was the Queen Mary that we went across, and the Queen Elizabeth was also in the service. And these ships were the queens of the Atlantic, transatlantic service that they had during the 19th. And so the Queen Mary, which normally carried about 22 passengers in peacetime, was converted to a troop ship. Mm-hmm. And so when we boarded the ship in New York in February of 1944, we found that there were 16,000 troops on this ship. And
wow.
I know.
Wow.
And it was amazing how they figured out how to conduct the voyage, because they had red, white, and blue sections of the ship, and you had wore a tag or a button which was that color, and you wouldn't dare go to a different part of the ship because you would cause a huge traffic jam.
Hmm.
And we had only two meals a day because it took 4 hours for one feeding.
I know you were worried about that. How am I going to survive meals a day?
Well,
I'd be with you in that regard.
Well, they helped out in that respect because after the first meal, they had a table set up with sandwiches. So you just grabbed a bunch of sandwiches and took them back to your cabin.
Hmm. And when you arrived in England, or in Scotland, I believe, you were welcomed. There were people out there cheering you on, weren't there?
Oh, it was amazing. The townsfolk came out and they were waving flags and welcoming us to their country.
Hmm. Did you notice a difference in terms of concern, in terms of a war effort, because there was some disagreement in the United States about whether or not, even after Pearl Harbor, we were going to enter this in a large way. Did you feel more of a sense of urgency because Hitler was closer and because the British had suffered from bombardments, et cetera, once you arrived there?
Oh, once we arrived in England, war was all around us.
Mm-hmm.
We were there. That was a combat zone, you might say. The Blitz had just caused so much damage in London. And the industrial cities that we went through were just, many of the buildings were leveled and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And every night, whenever there was an air raid, these big bright searchlights were waving through the skies looking for the enemy aircraft. It was war. We were there, and we could feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is the various sites in England were being built up with ammunition dumps and vehicles and trucks and tanks and airfields had aircraft that were partly assembled. And it was amazing. As you drove across England, you saw a tremendous amount of war material there.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the buildup for the D-Day battle, which was, you cite in your book, oh my gosh, I guess I just never saw those figures in a list. How many people were involved in this? It was absolutely an incredible event, wasn't it?
It certainly was, yeah, right. You didn't really know there were that many soldiers in England. I mean, we were really
packed. Imagine.
But the 3 days before D-Day, of course, the naval ships that were going to be involved in the landing, they had to come from their various ports in the eastern side of England or the western side, and they rendezvoused then in the English Channel. And it was the rendezvous spot was not quite halfway across the channel. It was called Piccadilly Circus, named after a Piccadilly Circus in London. Mm-hmm. And there they waited then until the Eisenhower made the decision to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then of course, the troops that were in the various waves that landed on June 6th, they were all already in their ships and going across the channel.
Mm-hmm. And you write about how dangerous it was, how paratroopers, the areas had been flooded by the Germans, and so many people met their deaths in those early waves, didn't they?
Yeah. The idea for the paratroopers to land behind the German lines during the night of June 6th in the darkness, and they would then meet up with the troops that were landing on the shore. And so the weather was one of the enemies there at the on D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
Because the channel was, the waves were so huge that many soldiers drowned before they ever got to the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And then and inland, there were some marshes there where they had dikes and so on, and the Germans broke those dikes open and flooded the whole place, and some of the paratroopers landed in some of those places where there was water, and they they drowned.
Mm.
As they landed.
Yeah. Did you, as a soldier, and did all other soldiers, have an idea of the enormity of what this operation was, or were you in the dark about it?
Well, we didn't have, you know, a lot of detail about it.
Uh-huh.
But you could feel it. As you drove around southern England, where I was stationed in the city of Marlborough, there was a tremendous amount of military traffic, and most of it was heading south to the coast, which was ready for the landings there. But we didn't really know exactly all the details, but you could feel it,
mm-hmm.
and the tenseness was there. And so we all knew it was imminent, but didn't know exactly what day the landing would take place.
But Hitler didn't think that that was going to happen.
No, he was, it was amazing because he was over in the Eagle's Nest, his retreat there, and Rommel, who had, was assigned to guard the beaches and shoot the American soldiers as they came on shore, it was all quiet and the weather was bad, so the Germans figured nothing would happen. So Rommel went home to visit his wife because it was her birthday.
Brought her fancy shoes from Paris.
Yes, he found some shoes in Paris, and he brought those home to her. Well, so while Rommel was home with his wife and Hitler was in his retreat, the landing took place. So Rommel had to hurry back as fast as he could.
Mm.
It's an amazing story.
Yeah. Was it, when you look at it in terms of military history, was this the largest invasion or the largest military maneuver almost in the history of the world? Is that going too far?
Yes, that's true. It is the largest in the history of the whole world.
Goodness.
Yeah.
And when did you make the crossing?
I crossed on D plus 46. That means 46 days after D-Day. And that date was July 22nd. And that was my 21st birthday.
Aww.
So I walked across the sands of Utah Beach. You know, all the ports in the Normandy area there were bombed. So our ships could not land at a dock. So what we did is we anchored outside of Utah Beach for me, and we got on a lighter, and they brought us ashore. And so at Omaha Beach, of course, that's where there was a big cliff, and the battle was very fierce there. Mm-hmm. But I did cross then on D plus 46, which was middle of July. Mm.
And then you crossed through France and...
Yes.
Yeah. Then you were seeing battle.
We crossed northern France. We went 600 miles in 30 days.
Goodness.
And we were the 20th Corps, which I was with, and our divisions, we were the spearhead of General Patton's army. And we just roared across France. And we would have gotten into Germany, I'm pretty sure, before the end of the year if we had not run out of gas.
Mm.
And so Patton was pretty upset about that because his tanks came to a standstill. Mm. Shortage of petrol.
Why do you call the book The Ghost in General Patton's Third Army?
I decided to use the word The Ghost because that was the nickname of the 20th Corps, of my unit, and that nickname was given to us by journalists, actually, who said that our method of advancing and attacking was to our divisions would go maybe surround a city or go on the other side of it and then squeeze it out. And we had the German High Command pretty well confused about that. So they figured that was a sort of we were the ghost.
We're going to go to phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. Our guest this hour is Eugene Schultz. His book has just been published, and you can go to Amazon and find it there. And actually, I hope some bookstore will have. That's what we need to have friends at Boswell have you for a book signing, because that would be wonderful. People should meet you, and you could sign your book and talk to them. So we'll talk to Daniel. Daniel, have a book signing at Boswell for Eugene Schultz. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, it would be good. All right, we'll try to make that happen. The book is The Ghost in General Patton's Third Army, the memoirs of Eugene Schultz during his service in the United States Army in World War II. And it's his story, and it's not only his moving personal story of what it's like to be a 19-year-old who's drafted into the Army in 1943 after you've had a very different kind of life, raised on a farm in Clintonville, Wisconsin. He was part of major events in World War II, including, and we haven't even gotten to this yet, being of an eyewitness to the first Nazi concentration camp, which is not a story that makes you feel good. It makes you sick, actually, but a story that needs to be told for all time, actually. All right, two phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Eugene Schultz, our guest. His book is The Ghost in General Patton's Third Army, the memoirs of Eugene Schultz during his service in the United States Army in World War II. Let us go to Harold in Superior, our first caller for Eugene. Hi, Harold.
Good morning. Thank you for writing the book. I just don't think we could have too many books on the war there. It's just, I reflect back, which I didn't do, unfortunately, in my younger years when my dad was alive. But, you know, what the people went through, the first there's a Great Depression and then there's a drought and World War I and then World War II and people just didn't have anything like today, and you try to make your kids understand how tough your parents had it. But my dad was in Normandy, and unfortunately, I never thought much about asking him much about it, and he never said much. He was very close-lipped about it. But he came back wounded both physically and mentally, and it affected our life, certainly. My dad was in Normandy, and I gather you're saying that you were as well, and... ended up in England in a hospital. The question I just popped into my head here just in the last recent months here is, why didn't they use bombers more? I see how they bombed over, Japan and Germany and other areas, and why didn't they first just strife the thing with Normandy with bombs?
Well, they did do a lot of bombing there, and if you go there today, you can see a lot of craters that were where bombs were dropped. The night before D-Day, there were going to be some bombing or some strafing missions there, but the weather was bad, and the clouds were low. And so the bomber pilots couldn't find their targets. And so that was one of the problems, too. It wasn't that successful.
Thank you, Harold. Harold talks about his father being quiet about his experiences. That case as well, Gene, did it take you a long time to write this book because you didn't want to think about this, or have you always been sharing your memories?
Yes, that's true that what all the veterans are talking about, that they never talked about it, and I was the same way.
Were you?
Yes.
Mm.
The thing is, when we got when I got discharged and the war was over, I felt I had done my duty for my country,
mm-hmm.
and I was now going to live a normal life, and I looked forward to an education and marriage and family and so on. And I think that's true with all the veterans that came back from the war. It was our job to do, and we did it, and let's get on.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not mention this, a lot of these stories to my own sons. I have five sons. And so some of these things I would maybe say in driblets here and there. I would tell my wife occasionally a story, but I just didn't do that.
Huh.
Until just a few, you know, maybe 20 years ago when I started talking.
Oh, I'm so glad you've done it now. Could you, I found this, maybe it's because you really set us up so well for the enormity of D-Day. Do you have the book in front of you?
Yes, I do.
FDR, I can just imagine him saying this, FDR's address when it was midnight on the 6th day of June, it was early evening back home in America in the White House, President Roosevelt sat in front of a microphone in the office where he gave his radio address to a nervous nation, citing the events of D-Day and the invasion of Hitler's occupied Europe by Allied forces. And you frame this in terms of you knew your mom and dad were listening to FDR and that they were very anxious. They didn't know where you were. And I read his address here. If you wouldn't mind reading some of it, and it just gave me goosebumps to read what he was saying because it's 126. It's part of FDR's address because it's beautifully written and it really calls on the Lord and everybody to think of everybody who's how massive this effort is and to think of all of the people who are fighting. It's really stirring.
Yes, this was a remarkable prayer that Roosevelt spoke. And here's what he said. Last night, when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far, and so in this poignant hour, I asked you to join me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of the nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard, for the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tired by night and by day without rest until the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by poison flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violence of war. For these men are lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters, and brothers of brave men overseas, those thoughts and prayers are ever with them. Help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith to thee in this hour of great sacrifice.
It is such a solemn and stirring and important prayer, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah. Just wonderful.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for the reading. You read
you're
beautifully.
Welcome.
All right. Let's go to back to phone calls. Don in Portage. Hi, Don.
Yeah, hi. See, as a young boy of about 13 or 14, I can remember that speech.
Really?
Yes. The second thing is I'd like to thank you for your service, sir, and all your comrades.
Thank you very much.
I'm just wondering if you have any recollection of the battle on the Mosdell River that took place in the first part of September. Do you have any memories of that?
Which river was that?
The Mosdell.
Oh, the Mosdell. Well, yes, September. I was stationed in Thionville, France, which was on the Moselle River. And about 30 miles south of Thionville was the city of Metz. And at Metz was the greatest fortress in all of France. And so you might be referring to that, because the Battle of Metz was to liberate that place, because it was one of the most heavily fortified fortresses that the Germans had there.
Mm. Thank you very much for the call, Don. Let's go to Ray in Eau Claire. Hi, Ray.
Good morning, Kathleen, and thank you, Eugene. It's very touching, everything that you're mentioning, and I'm looking forward to getting a copy of your book. I have had the privilege of twice or three times visiting Dachau, the concentration camp just outside of Munich, and it's very somber and it very stirs the heart to see the suffering of the people. And one day when I was there, some crisply uniformed, of their blue uniforms, young German military people were strolling in, their gloves tucked under their epaulettes on their shoulders, and they were fulfilling a requirement at the German military that every member at some time during his service career, perhaps several, has to visit one of the concentration camps. With the Germans, to their credit, have maintained openly as a display to that tragedy. And up front there are as a memorial that says in several languages, Hamas, jamais, niemals, never again. Hmm. My question to you is disturbing for me to ask, is because I have in my hands here a book by James Bach, Bacque, written 1991. It's called Other Losses, and he talks about the truth about the at the end of World War II, that Eisenhower was part of a policy that caused the deliberate death from exposure, fecal contamination, lack of food, of a massive number of disarmed German soldiers. And his book, James Bach, puts it between 800,000 and 900,000 disarmed German soldiers perished in Allied prison camps.
Are you aware of that, Gene?
No, I'm not aware of that. I haven't heard that.
Okay. The name of the book is Other Losses, and we'll just direct you to that. Well, if you want to send us more information, please do so, Ray, but we want to return to Gene's book. And let's go to the concentration camp that you were eyewitness to, the Ohrdruf concentration camp, a Nazi forced labor extermination camp, supplying slave labor for the construction of a railway to a communication center in Weimar. You were an eyewitness to absolute horror, weren't you?
Yes, I was an eyewitness. And what happened is that this was about April 5th, 1945. It was just only about a month before the war ended. And we were advancing very quickly across Germany, heading toward Berlin. And we were stationed in the city of Weimar. And just south of the city of Weimar is a small German town called Ohrdruf. That's spelled O-H-R-D-R-U-F. And one of our divisions liberated the town and they got to the outskirts of the town, they discovered this concentration camp where there were hundreds and hundreds of corpses lying around. And there were rumors. We had heard rumors that there were a number of concentration camps that the Nazis had developed, and but no one had seen one. And so now when these troops in our 20th Corps discovered this, this was the first realization that there were such things as these death camps. So General Eisenhower immediately visited it, along with General Patton and my own commanding general, General Walker, and they were just appalled at what they had seen. It was just much worse than they had expected. There were dead bodies all over the camp. They were in sheds, piled up like wood, and they were laid out in a meadow where they were waiting to bury them because there were trenches made nearby, but they never got that far. There were ovens there where they burned the bodies. And so this was just a horrible thing, much worse than our generals had expected. So General Eisenhower sent out an order that he wanted all American troops who were in the vicinity of Ohrdruf to go there because he wanted eyewitnesses. And he already was looking way down the pages of history.
Yes, he was.
And suspecting that people would not believe this.
Mm-hmm.
And it is true there are people today who say the Holocaust or these camps never existed. But so I was one of the eyewitnesses because a few days later, I went there with my boss and a couple other guys, and it was full of American soldiers wandering through this camp. Here's what happened. We walked into the camp, and there were some barracks along the way, which we went into, and we did not find any cots or beds there because the inmates, they slept on shelves,
mm-hmm.
like shelves that you might have in your basement, and that was their bed. They sometimes used the corner of the barracks for their toileting. Then we came to a square, a sort of a plaza, where there were some administration buildings. And in this plaza, I noticed there was some gallows. And this is where the inmates were probably put to be beaten if they didn't obey the rules. By the way, Ohrdruf was a work camp, not an extermination camp. So these people were building a railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what they did with the gallows there. Then we went inside of the administration building where the commandant and the SS guards worked. And as we looked around the office there, we noticed that there were books which had covers made out of human skin.
Mm-hmm.
And lampshades mm-hmm. made of human skin.
Mm-hmm.
There was on the wall. Mm. There was a framed, like a framed picture of the skin of a inmate, which had a tattoo on it. But these were twisted minds that these Nazis had, and they had this fetish about human skin, apparently.
Mm. And you had second thoughts about writing to your mother about all this, but you wrote to your brother about this. But by then, news was in newspapers all over the world.
That's right. When I got back to camp that night, I was just in a daze.
I imagine.
I was totally upset. But I had to tell the story, and so I wrote to my brother, and I said, if you feel that Mom and Dad can handle this, tell them. But by the time my letter got there, of course, this was world news, because by then other camps were discovered.
Mm-hmm.
Buchenwald, which is only 30 miles away from Ohrdruf. And near Munich, you have Dachau.
Mm-hmm.
and Auschwitz in Poland. Those are the biggies that were discovered. So, my letter then was published in the Clintonville paper.
They published the whole thing, didn't they?
Yeah. Entire letter. So it was, I should continue with Ordruff, if I may.
Yes, please.
So after all the American troops had seen all these bodies, and Eisenhower ordered that all the corpses remain there for several weeks. And, of course, then the stench came, was pretty bad. And one thing that just bothered me tremendously was the smell of the burned flesh. And it was such a nauseating kind of sweet smell. And it just was ingrained in my brain, and I smelled it for at least 3 or 4 months after that. Even though it wasn't there, I could smell it. So after the American troops had seen all this, then they ordered the citizens of Ordruff, the town, to go and see this. And, of course, these citizens said, oh, we didn't know this was going on. Well, guess what? It's interesting because the mayor was in the group, the mayor of Ordruff. And that night when he went home, he hanged himself.
Really?
So there's an interesting story. Yes.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Eugene Schultz. His book, The Ghost in General Patton's Third Army, it's his memoirs, the memoirs of Eugene Schultz during his service in the United States Army in World War II. Here's our number. We have time for a couple more calls, 800-486-8655. Email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, June in Shawano. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi, Eugene. I want to thank you also for your service. And also, I'm looking forward to reading your book. I had a friend who was the brother of a good friend of my brother's who was involved in this concentration thing. He was also very young, and I can't recall which concentration camp it was, but there were tunnels underneath it. And his name was Larvin Stibbs. He lived at Belle Plaine, which I'm sure you know where it is. And because he was thin and he had to crawl through these tunnels to find out if anyone was hiding there, be it an internee or a German who was involved in the camp. And it's something he always remembered, and it was very hard being so young. Our young people go to war and see terrible things, but this was probably the worst, as you well know. I also had a good friend whose name was Wayne. I can't recall his last name because I'm very bad with names at my age. And he was in the Battle of the Bulge. I got to know him because he was a greeter at Walmart, and I go there to the pharmacy, and we would talk about the war, and he told me about his experience at that time.
Thank you very much, June, for the call. She brings up the point of others who witnessed the kind of horrors that you just described, Jean, are sickening. I mean, they're sickening. It's hard to process when we first hear about the Holocaust when we're kids. It's hard to take it in. What do you do with that? Here you are, this kid who grew up on a farm in Clintonville. You are seeing things that you, I'm sure, never thought could have existed in the world. What do you do with all of the horrible things that you saw? Where do you put them in your mind?
Well, it's one of those things. I never told my parents the story, and they passed away without even knowing about the concentration camp. I never told that story. But it's one of those things I just forgot about it.
Really?
I don't know how you can do that, but I just forgot deliberately. And it's only in recent years now where I started to talk about it. And when I first told the story of the concentration camp, I would break down and cry. because it just brought back these horrible memories, and I could smell the burned flesh and all that stuff. But now, after I was able to go on the Honors Flight 2 years ago, the Stars and Stripes Honors Flight, now the folks at Stars and Stripes have asked me to talk to school children, and I do a lot of speaking now to school kids, history classes in high school.
I'm glad you are.
Even down to 7th and 8th graders. And I tell the story. And I show my pictures because I had a camera, and these are my own pictures that are in the book. And it's a story that has to be told. And you might say I'm still following General Eisenhower's order to tell the story.
Thanks, June, very much for your call. Let's go to Bob in Wisconsin somewhere. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Thank you very much. First of all, once again, thank you for your service.
Thank you.
My mother emigrated to America from Antwerp, Belgium, on the Queen Mary. She always talked about the ship. But my stepfather, Joel Smith from Flint, Michigan, was part of taking care of the tanks and the trucks as they went across northern France. And so in the 70s, I was fortunate enough to be able to go to Belgium a number of times. But on one trip with him, we went to all the cities that he went through. And so some of the names that you've mentioned are familiar. My question is whether or not you were at Bastogne.
If I was at Bastogne?
Yes.
No, I was not there during the Battle of the Bulge. I was 30 miles south of there because we were in the city of Thionville, France. And just north of us was Luxembourg. And Bastogne was right on the border of Luxembourg and Belgium. I did visit Bastogne in 1994 when I took my wife Eleanor to Europe, and I retraced all my steps.
You did.
32 command posts that the 20th Corps was in. And so then we went to Bastogne and saw the great museum there. It's just a marvelous thing. And so, yes, I did visit it later.
Hmm. Thank you very much for your call. And let's go to Nancy. We're running short on time in Grafton. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I was a farm girl, and we had a neighbor who was German. He said he'd rather take his son out in the barnyard and shoot and kill him than let him come and fight for the United States. This guy had made a good living. But I recently talked to a lady last week who was from Germany. She was a child in school at the time of this war, and she said they had to go in the bomb shelters. And she said, and then after the war was over, they were starving. They had no food. And she said, but England and the United States sent food over to those people in Germany. And she said, finally, we had something to eat. And she said, we little kids in school had to go and scrape the mortar off of bricks 2 to 3 hours a day so that they could rebuild. I'm telling you, young people today had to know those kind of stories. They need to know them. So it isn't repeated.
Thank you, Nancy, very much for the call. She's absolutely right, and congratulations to you for having written the book, because we do need to know these stories. And there's something about being able to take it all in when it's written from the perspective of at that beginning, 19-year-old from Clintonville, Wisconsin, who was just entering this, and you write it so well, and it's a good way for us to learn the history, I think, Gene.
Thank you so much, Kathleen.
Yeah, our pleasure. We'll try to set up this book signing. We'll do that when we get off.
Good. We'll look forward to that.
That would be great.
Terrific.
Yeah, thank you. The book is The Ghost in General Patton's Third Army. It's the memoirs of our guest this hour, Eugene Schultz, during his service in the United States Army in World War II. We should say that he went on, we never got to this, but he enrolled at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, took advantage of the GI Bill of Rights, got his bachelor's and master's in business administration, met his wife Eleanor, who's with us in the studio at the university. They were married in 49, and he worked as an investment research officer at Northwestern Mutual Life for 36 years. So, well, we'll be with you again tomorrow. And we'll have an early Father's Day celebration with Jim Gaffigan, who's a funny guy, tomorrow, and in more conversation. There's other great conversations to be had as the day moves along. Thanks very much to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. This is the Ideas Network.